The House will be leaving town today, heading back to our states, heading back to our districts. Obviously, this will be a week of Thanksgiving. And obviously, I wish all of my colleagues well and safe travel. And we have much, of course, for which to be thankful in this great country. But there are great concerns that we face. Today, obviously, we had the speech and the news about the future of Speaker Pelosi. The outgoing speaker has had a long career in this body, and I wish her well. I wish her the best in the next chapter of her life. And some are saying it's an end of an era. And I would say that it's only an end of an era if we choose to make it so. Speaker Pelosi ran this chamber not terribly unlike her Republican predecessors, and I don't necessarily mean that to be the right way to do things. Bills that are cooked up in small rooms among leadership staff and members of leadership. Thousands of pages of legislation dropped on members at the 11th hour. Key pieces of legislation that are shuttled through committee without significant debate and then dropped on the floor. Sometimes we have what's called suspension votes, where we suspend the rules and we have votes on the floor with no members here to debate it or discuss it. Just take the word of the committees on which I don't serve. Amendments on the floor of this body restrained since May of 2016 under both parties' leadership. Some people refer to this as a cartel. Some refer to it as the swamp. What it is, regardless of branding, we know that it takes power away from the legislators and thereby takes power away from the people who sent their legislators here to represent them. The only way we're going to make this the end of an era is if we change the way we do things. And we should. And I'm saying this now that there is a Republican majority about to take the gavel. I believe we have to change the way this town works. I believe we have to change the way this body works. The reason that I introduced the Article I Act in the first Congress that I served in this body while President Trump was in office to reclaim power from the executive branch, to say that we must have a voice in these ongoing emergency declarations, some of which date back to the 1970s. The reason that I did that was because I believed it, even though it would have taken power away from a Republican president. I'm wondering now if some of my Democratic colleagues will think, well, maybe that's not a terrible idea if we look ahead. I don't know. Here in this chamber, I am as a Republican calling on a fundamental change in the way we do things here, how bills get to the floor. Most people might not understand that the default rules that would go back to the Jefferson Manual and the basic rules of parliamentary procedure would be that I have the right to be able to offer a bill and that then you'd be have the right to amend the bill here on the floor of this body. This being the floor of the House of Representatives. But what the American people don't know is that every Congress we come in and we vote on new rules. And we vote on rules that then restrict the power of every member of this body to be able to represent their constituents. We restrict the power of a member to offer a bill, to bring that bill to a vote, to have debate on that bill, to amend that bill here on the floor of the House of Representatives. That's the way it works. And then we even go further. Every week we fly in and then we have votes on rules. Rules that are cooked up among 13 members of the House of Representatives who sit up in a committee up here behind these walls and they vote a new rule. Send it down here and then the body votes on the rule that then structures debate for the week. Then can I offer an amendment here on the floor? No. And you know why? Because people are afraid to vote. Members of this body sent to vote on legislation and to represent their constituents are afraid to vote. Can you imagine? In the founding of this country, the establishment of this body, the People's House, to go get reelected every 2 years, or to go seek reelection, that we're afraid to vote? Do you know how many times, if I bring up opening the process and opening up the floor of the House, colleagues on my side of the aisle, the other side of the aisle, go, well, you know, don't you know, that means somebody could bring up a really tough vote. Well, if you vote no on a whole lot of tough votes, like I tend to do, you get kind of used to it. And you get used to what you have to do, which is go explain to your constituents why there ain't no free lunch. This isn't the United States House of Free Stuff. You can't just keep passing bills to spend money we don't have to buy off votes. You can't keep voting for bills that have a nice title so that you don't have to go back and explain why you voted, as I did, against burn pit legislation for veterans who need support and help for burn pits. But you vote against it because you don't need another $675 billion mandatory spending item. Yet bipartisan support for a bill, because nobody wants to go say no. Nobody wants to go look in a veteran's eye and explain the hard reality of what we need to do in this body. Nobody wants to say no to a bill that says ALS research. Nobody wants to say no to a bill that says something about helping animals or helping old people or helping kids. You put a nice title in there, then everybody's got to vote for it. Doesn't matter which side of the aisle you're on, you got to vote for it. Because there is no spending limit. There is no restraint. There is no responsibility. There is no leadership. There is no check on unrestrained power of the executive branch by this body, because this body keeps funding the very tyranny of the executive branch that many campaign against. That's the truth. My colleagues on this side of the aisle just went out and sought election, where we took the House back. My colleagues on this side of the aisle went out and campaigned against unrestrained federal power in the Federal Bureau of Investigation, a Department of Homeland Security that refuses to secure the border of the United States, labeling of parents as domestic terrorists. They went out and campaigned against an energy policy of an administration that is destroying American energy, driving the price of gas up, driving the price of electricity up, destroying the grid of the United States, making us more dependent on China, on Venezuela, on Russia, on Saudi Arabia, on Iran. It's absurd. We ran against all that stuff, but you know what? Whole lot of my colleagues vote to fund all that stuff. Have no problem writing a big old check. Both sides of the aisle. You know why? Because they always have something they want that they're willing to just sign off on a monster piece of legislation, irrespective of the debt that is piling up around the ears of their kids and their grandkids, the destruction of the American dream that is happening because of that, or the funding of the very bureaucrats that are undermining the freedoms of the United States people every day. Come to the floor, it's got a National Defense Authorization Act. You come to the floor and you've got something you must pass. We have to pay for the pay raise for our troops. We must pay for some more planes and bombers and helicopters, missiles. Don't you know, Chip, that we've got to go stand up against China? We got to fund Ukraine. We got to stand up against Putin. Great. Let's have a debate on this floor about those things. If you're talking about war, maybe we should declare it. If you think that there's a proxy war with funding, maybe we should debate it on the floor of this body. Maybe you shouldn't just keep writing blank checks and never have a debate about guns and butter. But that's what we do. And this is where I got to have a little tough talk to my colleagues on this side of the aisle. What, pray tell, have you heard out of anybody on this side of the aisle that will change any of that? Yesterday, we had all sorts of conference meetings, debates about our internal workings. I tend to like to keep those meetings confidential and private, but half my daggum colleagues are tweeting that stuff out in real time. The fact of the matter is, nothing changed. The status quo remains because people want their power. They want their committee chairmanships. They want their gavel. They want the ability to control the power and the purse strings, but they don't want to look in the mirror to fundamentally change a broken town, a broken house, a broken body, a broken federal government that is stepping all over the dreams and the hopes and the future and the prosperity of the American people. There is not a remote indication that my colleagues on my side of the aisle understand what time it is in America, understand what we're facing. It's not just a campaign statement. It's not just something to go rile up the American people to get elected. To get elected, to get power, to get on a certain committee. Do you know what every conversation that has been had in this body, at least on my side of the aisle, since last Tuesday? Hey, what's going on in the steering committee? Hey, who's going to get Ways and Means? Hey, who's going to get on what committee? Hey, did the freshmen have their votes? Who's going to be the head of the freshman class? Hey, who's going to be the speaker? Who's going to be the whip? I don't know. Let's figure out what we're going to do. Who's going to have power? Who's going to have power? Who's going to have power? And the answer is anybody but the American people. The answer is anybody but the rank and file members of this body. The answer is the status quo. That's why people ran. That's why President Trump, by the way, did well in 2016 running against the swamp. Say what you want about President Trump. He represented a large block of this country that were sick and tired of this town, of this place, of this body, of the people in this room. And it's high time we do something about it. Stop kissing each other's rear ends, asking and begging for some slot on a committee. We didn't come here to be on committees. We didn't come here to get a title. The titles around this place. Who is in leadership? Leadership. Isn't leadership something you recognize and follow? It's not something you elect. I didn't come here for second place. I didn't come here. I don't leave my family. I don't say goodbye to my son and my daughter and my wife every Monday and fly up here and spend 3, 4, 5 days up here and fly back every week just because I want to earn Southwest points. I didn't fly up here because I want to sit in rooms and go have a steak dinner and go talk to lobbyists about what needs to be put in a bill. I didn't come up here to say, well, we got to make sure we get, but don't call them earmarks. Oh, don't call them earmarks. That's already bad out there. So we're going to call them community-directed spending. Okay, we'll call them community-directed spending. The currency of this town. How are you going to take care? How are you going to get a bridge back home? Hey, it's important. We have floods in Houston. We have floods in Louisiana or Florida. So, they need flood money, right? Oh, we have tornadoes in the Midwest. Well, we need some tornado money. Well, how do you think you get people to buy? How do you think you get people to vote for all these appropriations bills that have left your country $32 trillion in debt? By the way, 5% interest rates. Do you know what's going to happen? Interest rates going up where they are at 5%. You know what's going to happen to the interest payments? It's going to be another $600, $700, $800 billion. You pretty much just bought a whole second Department of Defense, ladies and gentlemen, with money that you're printing. How's that sound? Enjoy that, do you? And nobody here has any plan on what to do about it except more of the same. Oh, we'll have a lot of speeches about CHIP. Don't you understand? Entitlements, mandatory spending, that's the problem. That's 70% of the whole thing. Well, as a technical matter, that's not incorrect. But we got here because we refused to deal with it. And that's not an excuse to write a blank check for discretionary spending. Hey, we don't need to be responsible on discretionary spending because the actual problem is the rest of the spending. Even though discretionary spending is still $1.5, $1.6, $1.8, $2 trillion. Or is it $7 trillion? Does anybody know? Does anybody care? Hey, we shut down the whole country under COVID. Hell, we'll just write a $5 trillion check. Why not? Because that's what we do. We just keep writing checks that we can't cash.